Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
A better understanding of how microbes are contributing to the health of the bee will help us to understand how we can make a more healthy bee, not just in terms of probiotics, but in terms of management.
Irene Newton is an assistant professor of biology at Indiana University and the co-author of a new study that's the first to look at the microbiome of queen bees. She'll walk us through the research in today's show. Organic farmers disagree on how to market their products, specifically who should be paying for promotional campaigns. Last week, we talked about Indian food with author Colleen Taylor Sen. She's back today to tell us what to expect when we order a curry and a vegetarian dish with Chef Daniel Orr, coconut milk, curry powder, cilantro, and yams. Starting off our headlines with Luann Johnson with news of a massive recall.
NPR reported this week that Kraft Foods is recalling about 6.5 million boxes of original flavor Kraft macaroni and cheese because some of the boxes contain small pieces of metal. The boxes have best when used by dates ranging from September 18 through October 11, 2015, and are marked with the code C2. Kraft Foods Group Incorporated says consumers should return the macaroni to the store where it was purchased for a full refund. And a bit of good news for Kraft. The Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics awarded its first Kids Eat Right label to Kraft Singles. How they ended up with the endorsement of a major trade group is about as confusing as the difference between processed cheese food and prepared cheese product. Kraft Singles, by the way, are labeled as pasteurized prepared cheese product. The Academy's executive director denied that the presence of the label meant the Academy was endorsing the product, but Kraft and consumers see it differently. Kraft told the New York Times it was the first time the Academy had endorsed a product, and studies have backed up how confused parents are when it comes to healthy marketing to their kids. Kraft cleaned house at its executive level after a disappointing financial year in 2014. Coca-Cola also fell on hard times in 2014. The soda giant is trying to figure out the best path forward, and they're banking on milk. The company has introduced Minute Maid Fairlife Milk, a lactose-free, high-protein, less sugar, and more calcium version of milk. Fairlife has an extended shelf life, meaning it lasts about 100 days versus milk's average of 14 days. Strangely, though, Coca-Cola is entering the dairy industry when milk consumption is at a low. Premium milk comes at a premium price. A 52-ounce bottle of Fairlife costs $4.59, while a regular half-gallon of milk costs around $3.99.
You will find links to these stories on eartheats.org. Share them on your Twitter and Facebook, and be sure to mention us. We're at Earth Eats. Till next week, Luann.
Have a good one.
In the top pork-producing states, many farmers are under contract with giant meat packers like Smithfield Foods. The packers actually own the pigs and pay the farmers to raise them. Nebraska is one of the last states to outlaw that kind of contract. But some lawmakers there want to change that. As Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media reports, the debate brings out different ideas on how to grow the farm economy.
The winter wind cuts across Terry O'Neill's farm near Friend in eastern Nebraska. But his pigs don't feel the chill. They're tucked away in heated steel barns across the yard from his home.
We just weaned approximately 500 head of pigs today, and they're in a facility that's 85 degrees, just about like being down in the Caribbean.
O'Neill started farming in the mid-80s with 40 pigs outside on dirt. Then the pork industry changed, and he changed with it. He put up long hog barns, each housing hundreds of pigs. He still thinks of himself as small.
We have about 7,000, which by industry standards could be on the smaller side if you look at the whole scope of the industry.
And when O'Neill looks at the scope of the pork industry, he sees Nebraska losing ground, especially compared to the top pork state, Iowa, right next door. Both states have lost hundreds, even thousands of hog farms in the last 20 years, but Iowa has added millions of animals at the same time. That's come with some environmental challenges, to be sure, but what bothers O'Neill is that a lot of Iowa's pigs are processed in Nebraska packing plants.
We're missing out on that opportunity. I've seen what's happened in Iowa. I'm seeing what's happening in South Dakota. It seems like we are becoming an island.
He calls Nebraska an island because the state prohibits meat companies from owning livestock. Iowa and other Midwestern states also used to ban corporate farming to protect family-owned operations. But after a slew of court challenges, Nebraska's packer ban is one of the only laws left standing. In states like Iowa and Minnesota, many farmers now have contracts to feed pigs owned by meatpacking companies like Cargill or Tyson. You can't do that in Nebraska. And Nebraska State Senator Ken Shills says it's getting in the way of rural growth.
We've been in population decline for the last 50 years. And so we probably better start doing things to entice people to come back.
Shills introduced a bill that would lift the packer ban on livestock ownership, but only for hogs, not cattle. Let's say a farm family doesn't have enough land to bring a son or daughter back in the business. Shills says with a packer contract, maybe they could get a loan for a hog barn. But critics say that would mean giving up the most valuable part of the farm.
We think farmers should own livestock in this state, not packers.
That's Tracy Bruckner of the Center for Rural Affairs. Bruckner says Nebraska's ban on packer ownership prevents meat companies from dominating the pork industry the way they do the chicken industry. She says consumers might not notice, but you can see the results in farm country.
If vertical integration was the answer, then rural America would be a paradise right now. And it's not.
Instead of more hog buildings on fewer farms, Bruckner wants to see more farms adding smaller numbers of pigs. And she says promoting packer-owned livestock makes that more difficult for hog farmers like Ryan Schieffer.
I see that old barn with rusted tin on top, but it still shelters those girls just fine.
Schieffer's farm is a throwback. He raises a few hundred hogs a year near Crofton in northeast Nebraska. The animals wander in and out of open pens that have been around for decades. Until recently, Schieffer was still trying to sell to big packers for commodity prices. But that traditional cash market barely exists today.
It's gotten to the point now where that's not working anymore. I mean, it worked in my dad's generation in the 80s, 90s. You know, now it just doesn't fly.
Last year, Schieffer and his wife Jessica started raising red wattle hogs. It's a heritage breed. Now they sell meat directly to individuals and restaurants as Highland Hills Farm. He says it's working, but it's a different business.
You can do a lot with a little, I think, if you want to raise them this way, but it's not just take these to Tyson or Smithfield or whoever buys it. You have to find your own market, so that's where it gets tricky.
And that's really what's happening as the pork industry becomes more concentrated. Small and mid-sized producers are forced to either get bigger, get out, or get into a niche market. Taking away Nebraska's packer ban would give farmers another way to grab a share of the pork industry. But the concern is whether that could actually leave hog farmers with fewer ways to compete in the long run. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
A story later in the show about an issue that's dividing organic farmers. Who should pay for campaigns promoting organic food? Hear that ahead on Earth Eats. The community of bacteria that share your guts with you is called your microbiome. All animals have it, and it helps us stay healthy, or in some cases, it can make us sick. A new study has been published that gives us a better idea of what's happening inside the guts of queen bees. Irene Newton is a corresponding author of the study. She and Heather Matilla of Wellesley College and David Tarpe of North Carolina State looked at commercial beekeeping practices, in specific, the rearing of new queen bees. Their study is the first comprehensive analysis of queen bees' microbiome. Irene Newton came into the Earth Eats studios to talk about the takeaways.
And the queens are so central to honeybee productivity and the colony that we thought it really important to understand their microbial composition and also whether this practice that beekeepers have of moving the queens from colony to colony during the rearing impacts the microbial community in any way.
I hope you can explain that a little bit more. A queen doesn't stay with her colony of worker bees her whole life?
Well, the natural way that queens would be superseded is, say, you know, you have a honeybee colony and it loses the queen. All the workers will create several larval queens by feeding them royal jelly for a substantially larger amount of time than it is normal for worker bee larvae. So it's just this food, this one difference in diet during that critical developmental stage that will determine whether or not the worker will become a queen and be reproductively viable. So then those queens, if several emerge at the same time, they fight each other, actually, in the battle royale is what it's called.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
When one survives, one is mated, one becomes the mother to the rest of the colony and continues to lay offspring and is genetically related to the workers that rear her. But in the bee rearing practice, in the practice of creating these queens, which many people...
This is commercial beekeeping. This is what happens.
This is what happens, if, yeah, okay. Like if you order a queen from any of these different apiaries that you can buy queens from. So instead, you start with a colony called the grafting source, which is where larvae are fed royal jelly. So it's a queenless colony where they're trying to create queens. The larvae are moved to the cell builder where they pupate, and so they're further nurtured by this unrelated colony of workers. And then after they pupate, they move to another colony called the mating nucleus, where they're mated with drones. And then they're moved to their final colony. So throughout this process, they're interacting with a very large set of diverse, unrelated workers. And it's also a lot of handling on the part of the beekeeper himself.
Going into this research, what did you think you were going to find?
Well, you know, interestingly, David Tarpey, who studies queen development in bees, he had an interesting hypothesis coming into it that I thought would be curious to investigate. The queens are being reared by all these different worker populations, do those workers leave a microbial signature on the queen? So we wanted to track 40 different queens along their developmental trajectory, as well as the workers that interacted with them at each stage of development. And so our hope was, you know, we could see if some of these workers and their specific microbial signatures would leave an impact at a certain stage. But in fact, we saw something completely different.
Which is that they weren't related at all.
Exactly. And that workers have their own microbial signatures, and queens are very distinct from workers with regards to the microbes in their guts.
Can you tell me why this is significant?
So it's significant in two different ways. The queens are, for example, genetically identical to their sisters. The only thing that's different is their diet. The diet that they're fed has an enormous impact, it turns out, on the microbes that are present. They're fed this royal jelly, which is actually a product of a specific worker organ, the hypopharyngeal gland. And this gland, as it turns out, contains a specific kind of bacterium in high quantity. And so that is influencing the composition of the queen's gut. The other reason that it's important or interesting is that the norm for animals is maternal transmission of the microbial community. So human infants, for example, when they are born, are first inoculated with their mother's vaginal flora if they're born by vaginal delivery. If they're born by C-section, then the first thing they interact with are skin microbes. But that first inoculation is maternal. And in the case of the bees, that doesn't seem to be the case at all, because the queen, not only does she not rear her offspring, she also doesn't even have the microbes necessary to transmit them. The microbes that we consider to be core to the worker bees aren't found in the queens.
When we talk about bees, the topic always has to come back to colony collapse disorder is a significant problem. Does your study address the health of bees big picture?
I think it does, to in one very important way, very directly address management of bees, and that is that it doesn't seem to be the case that the current bee rearing practice and the way that beekeepers raise these queens and transfer them colony to colony, that doesn't seem to impact the final microbial community in the queens at all. So that's good news for beekeepers, and that they don't have to worry about the kinds of workers that are interacting with the queen at every stage. That said, the broader goal of our laboratory is to understand what makes a healthful microbiome for a bee. The goal being, you know, any animal that is well-nourished, that is healthy, will be better able to withstand the environmental onslaughts that the bees will have to face. Every winter, we're losing bees with global warming and with pesticide uses and with pathogens potentially cropping into the population. This will only get worse. So the better we can understand how to make a more healthy bee, the better it will be for the sustainability of our agricultural system and for food security.
The idea of making a healthy bee. That's interesting. We want to manipulate nature to make a healthy animal.
Well, I think it's more that we want to understand the practices that would make for a healthy hive. For example, we know that genetic diversity contributes to productivity, to a more healthful colony that can better withstand disease. So increasing the number of drones that are mated with the queen increases colony genetic diversity. And that's one way where you can, you know, quote, make a better bee. But I think, you know, in the larger scheme of things, a better understanding of how microbes are contributing to the health of the bee will help us to understand how we can make a more healthy bee, not just in terms of probiotics, but in terms of management.
Irene Newton is an assistant professor of biology at Indiana University. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And the title of the study is Characterization of the Honeybee Microbiome Throughout the Queen Rearing Process. Coming up, meal planning advice from the Caribbean.
You can just have your 3 to 4 ounces of protein and then have larger portions of the provisions and the good leafy vegetables and that kind of thing.
Chef Daniel Orr's provision of choice today, yams. That recipe after this. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations, bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats. Hello again, I'm Annie Corrigan. There's a battle brewing among organic farmers. The largest trade association in the industry wants growers to help pay for promotional campaigns. But deciding how to spread the organic message is dividing the sector into factions. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports.
I'm standing outside a Sprouts market here in Greeley, Colorado. People are walking out with carts and groceries, and some of that food sports a little seal for USDA organic. And more shoppers are looking for that logo. Organic food sales jumped to $35 billion in 2013. But what are people seeing when they see that logo?
It just means that it's not grown with pesticides or any sort of hormone ever.
And I know it's misleading, and it's doesn't mean there's no pesticides or no preservatives.
That it doesn't have pesticides or, I don't know. Is that right?
Ask a shopper what the organic seal is meant to convey, and you're bound to get an array of answers.
There's lots of confusion in the marketplace about what exactly organic means.
Missy Hughes is board president of the Organic Trade Association, the nation's most influential organic group. To clear up confusion, the OTA wants to borrow an idea used for decades by their conventional counterparts. It wants to set up an industry-wide fund for marketing and research called a checkoff.
There is a lot of controversy around checkoffs, and the way that they've been constructed in the past has really resulted in this lack of transparency, concerns about corruption, and concerns that they're not really meeting the needs of the farmers.
Here's how a checkoff works. Each farmer pays a small amount into a fund. It could be a penny on a bushel of wheat or a dollar per cow. Pool that money together, and you have millions to pay for research on new crops and beginning farmer education. And you can develop splashy promotional campaigns, like
got milk
and
pork, the other white meat.
An organic checkoff could bring a catchy tagline to the country's more than 18,000 certified organic producers. Think organic.
It's what's for dinner.
But some farmers say promotion unfairly benefits big companies. Some groups have already said they'll fight the organic checkoff tooth and nail.
There's always this debate about scale in organic agriculture, and I believe that that's entirely the wrong debate.
That's Dave Carter, a former member of the group that creates the standards for organic agriculture. There's a schism between billion-dollar organic companies and small local farmers who, if they make a certain amount of money, would be forced to pay into the fund. Some worry about big organic with a capital B.
You know, that's the challenge is organic is such a rich, broad message that's where we're kind of losing the debate right now is it encompasses so many things.
It'll be a little muddy out here, but we can...
Jason Condon and his wife Natalie grow certified organic vegetables in Lafayette, Colorado, near Denver. Farmers would be the biggest group paying into the proposed checkoff. And farmers of mid-size operations like Condon's Isabel Farm have been the toughest sell.
It sounds kind of bad, and I hate to say it this way, but it's not my job to make sure that there's organic across the country.
The farm pulls in close to $1 million in annual revenue. But like most farmers, Condon's margins are still tight. If the checkoff becomes reality, he could be required to pay upwards of $1,000 a year. He prefers marketing to his neighbors, nearby restaurants and grocery stores.
This checkoff thing just feels very contrary to that. It's sort of, no, you're not doing it good enough. Let's take your money and give it to some high-paid Washington folks that can really do some good.
Advocates are still trying to convince farmers like Condon that the checkoff is a good idea. Eventually, more than two-thirds of organic producers would have to vote in favor for it to go into effect. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Let me direct you to harvestpublicmedia.org for more stories from this food and agriculture reporter collective. South Asian food has become a global commodity. But what are the characteristics of this food? And what do we even mean when we use the word curry? Jamie Ordonez explores these questions through the story of one Pakistani-American family's food traditions.
I think that you should get the chicken curry or the chicken kadai.
I'm in Amrit India restaurant. I'm with my good friend Amira Siddiqui. She's never been here before, but she's used to eating this food. Her parents are from Pakistan and immigrated to Indianapolis in their mid-20s, which is where she's grown up. She got the chicken curry, which is kind of funny because Amira doesn't usually use the word curry to describe South Asian food.
The word curry is never really actually used in any of like the dishes that we make at home, but I know that like in America, people associate curry with Indian food. Mm-hmm. So if someone like asks me what is Pakistani food like, the only way I know how to describe it to them in a way that they'll understand is saying, oh, it's like curry.
Curry, it's got a little bit of a history. I mean,
that's Colleen Taylor-Sen speaking. She's written six books about Indian food, even one simply titled Curry. She gave a long, complicated explanation of the word, but boiled down to its simplest definition, curry is...
any Indian dish with a gravy. It could be made with meat or fish or vegetables. And it has, of course, spices.
To clarify, when we say the word gravy, we're not talking about what you put on your turkey or your biscuits. We just mean sauce. So curry is a dish with meat or poultry mixed with some spices and vegetables stewed in a sauce. Simple enough.
It's really spicy?
It's like really spicy.
Back at the restaurant, we have our food. I got chicken kadai and asked for a level 3 for spiciness. Any of their dishes can be ordered from spice level 1, no spice, to spice level 6, way too spicy. Amira got a level 4, which even her experienced Pakistani palate found almost too spicy. Amira's mom's cooking is pretty traditional Pakistani, and she cooks it most nights of the week. So when Amira's down at college, which is an hour from home, she comes to restaurants like Amrit to get similar foods. If she orders something like butter chicken or chicken tikka masala, those are just like some of the dishes her mom makes.
It's like pieces of chicken like in that sauce, which is like very typical of like the type of food my mom makes. But there's so many different types, and we call it like masala, which is like what adds all the taste, and then like the different spices you use. But then like in Indian restaurants, I feel like butter chicken and chicken tikka masala are like the only ones that they ever really have.
And our expert, Colleen, agrees with that statement.
The Indian Indian restaurants here are pretty limited. They all kind of serve a similar menu. They'll kind of feature like kebabs. So I have kind of a general North Indian menu with a few South Indian dishes thrown in.
If we were going to eat kebabs in the Siddiqui household, it would be beef, chicken, or goat, but not pork grilled on a skewer. Mrs. Siddiqui has tried to keep her recipes traditional despite living in suburban Indiana. But the family finds ways to put a Pakistani twist on American foods.
Anytime we make any sort of like pasta or chicken or like even like burgers and stuff, they always add like some sort of spice or something in it. And like the other weekend I was home and like my dad made a turkey sandwich, but he put chutney that you eat like samosas with in the turkey sandwich.
And as far as the future of the cuisine in the Siddiqui family, well, we'll see about that. I asked Amira if she knew how to cook Pakistani food.
No, not at all. My mom will have me help her in the kitchen, but it'll just be like, dice those tomatoes or like peel that potato. If she ever was like, oh, Amira, go make some like chicken korma, I would have no idea what I was doing, which I should probably learn.
She graduates from college in 2 months, and she plans to move to the East Coast. Her mom learned to cook Pakistani food out of necessity when she came to America. Maybe Amira will do the same when she moves away from home. For Earth Eats, I'm Jamie Ordonez.
Jamie is our intern at Earth Eats right now. Glad to have her on board. Hear more from her in the coming months. Subscribe to Earth Eats on iTunes to hear everything we produce. And our recipe today is inspired by the West Indies. Chef Daniel Orr worked in Anguilla for 2 years. He learned this yam salad recipe from a Jamaican cook he worked with on the islands. Yams are an example of ground provisions in the Caribbean, which are staple ingredients that oftentimes grow in the ground, although plantains are also considered provisions.
You know, taro root or even tapioca root. So you can just have your 3 to 4 ounces of protein and then have larger portions of the provisions and the good leafy vegetables and that kind of thing.
If you've got your smartphone handy, go to eartheats.org to follow along with this recipe.
We're going to start, instead of using oil in this, we're going to use coconut milk. Okay, our acid today is going to be lime juice. Okay, we're going to add some red onion. All right, and then we have about 2 large sweet potatoes. They're cooked and diced. We've got about a half cup of chopped mint, one of my favorite herbs. Again, roughly chopped scallions. We want to add a touch of sweetness, so we're going to add honey. We're going to stir this all around. Finish this with just a little bit of sherry vinegar. This is a Spanish sherry vinegar. It's called Xerez. It's got a really nice kind of smoky flavor from the sherry casks that the vinegar's aged in. Okay, I'm going to add a couple teaspoons of curry powder, getting to that West Indian flavor. Okay, let me give it a little taste. So let me put this on a plate, and then I'm going to sprinkle it with some coconut so it gives a little bit of crunchiness to it. Garnish it with some limes. And you got a perfect starter, and heck, I think that'd probably cost you $1, $1.50 to make it home.
This dish is as pretty as it gets with the orange yams, the red onions, and the green herbs. Visit our Twitter feed and you'll see a picture of it with a link to the recipe. Easy to find us at Earth Eats. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Enjoy some local food in this gorgeous early spring weather. Cheers, everybody. I'm Annie Corrigan.